Patients. I'm Deepa Olapalli. I'm the Associate Director of the Seeger Center and a Research Professor of International Affairs. Welcome to the event today. Thanks for braving the weather. We had actually almost 70 RSVPs. I think either people have been slowed down or defeated by the rain. But I think the event today is something that is very much on the agendas in Washington. When you look around to see, there's lots of stuff going on the question of the Indo-Pacific connectivity questions and the new initiatives that are being rolled out. People trying to get a sense of what these new initiatives are adding up to, what the driving forces are of things like the Belt and Road Initiative, and which we have heard much about. Less known is something called the Asia-Africa Growth Corridor that Japan and India have launched. And so one of the things that I wanted to do was to bring both of these large connectivity initiatives in Asia to Washington to have a closer look at this. And in order to do that, of course, I'm very happy to say that we have three leading international scholars, two of them from right here at George Washington, and one all the way from New Delhi, who just arrived yesterday. So hopefully he won't fall asleep in the middle of the his presentation at 1 o'clock. One of the things that they've all, of course, written quite a bit on many of these initiatives, but I had asked if each one of them could perhaps focus a bit on some of the big questions and hopefully at least touch on some of them. So one question would be, given that we have experts on Japan, India, and China at the table, to look and see what the concept of Indo-Pacific, how that's conceptualized, what the vision is for the Indo-Pacific, and any overarching strategy for that for their country. What are the main drivers of their vision for the Indo-Pacific? Is it strategic or economic? And where do the specific BRI, AAGC, where does it fit into the bigger equation? And do they see a role for the United States? What kind of role would they like for it? And finally, the big question, are we moving, is it towards connectivity / cooperation, or is it setting up setting up a scene for competition and perhaps even conflict? So those are some of the overarching questions that we'll be interested in talking about. So we're going to start with, I'll introduce all three of them, but we'll start with Professor Mike Mochizuki, who is a colleague here, Associate Professor of Political Science and International Affairs, as well as he holds a chair in Japan-U.S. relations. He is extremely widely published on Japan. He's on Japan foreign relations, especially an expert on Japan-China. And Japan-U.S. relations. And his most recent book has been actually a co-edited volume with myself called Asia, Energy Security in Asia and Eurasia. Then we will move to Dr. Jagannath Pandey, who's coming from the Institute for Defense Studies and Analysis in Delhi, which is the key strategic think tank for the Ministry of Defense. But as we were talking over lunch, they do have more autonomy than it might sound. He has written extensively on East Asia. He's the head of the East Asia section in IDSA. He's been very involved with Track 1.5 dialogues, Track 2 dialogues, and he's written quite extensively. I'm one of the few people, actually, to have written on the Asia-Africa Growth Corridor, so I'm delighted that he would be able to come here. He has written several books, and his most recent one is called India-China Relations, Politics of Resources, Identity, and Authority in a Multipolar World Order. Quite a mouthful, but I'm sure it's very interesting that, given all those topics. And finally, we will round it off with Professor Bob Sutter, who's again another colleague from here, Professor of Practice of International Affairs. He has, of course, written quite extensively and very well known here. His most recent books are Foreign Relations of the PRC, Legacies and Constraints of China's International Politics, and then another one, U.S.-China Relations, Perilous Past, Uncertain Present. And perilous present could be also a term, given what we're seeing in the news right now. So I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Mike Mochizuki, to start us off. Thanks, Mike. And we'll have Q&A afterwards.
Yeah, thank you very much, Deepa, for the introduction and for organizing this panel. I guess in some respects, it's fitting that we start the discussion with Japan, because I would believe that Prime Minister Abe of Japan takes great pride in the development of the free and open Pacific, and he believes that he was one of the architects of that concept. And the development of that concept took place over, I would say, a 10-year process, starting with the first Abe administration. In that first Abe administration, the foreign minister was Taro Aso, and he launched the notion of the arc of freedom and prosperity, and the argument was that Japan should pursue a values-oriented diplomacy that emphasized the universal values of democracy, freedom, human rights, the rule of law, and the market economy. And then in August 2007, Abe makes a speech at the Indian Parliament when he talks about the confluence of two oceans, the Indian Ocean and the Pacific Ocean, and he argues that the strategic global partnership of Japan and India is pivotal for the success of this arc of freedom and prosperity. Now, as you know, he resigns from the prime ministership in September 2007, and I expected that he would never come back. But he does reemerge as prime minister, and right before he returns to the prime ministership, he writes an article that promotes his notion of Asia's democratic security diamond, which entails a security coalition of Japan, the United States, Australia, and India. And the argument was that all of these are democracies that share common and universal values, again, freedom, rule of law, human rights, and market economies, and all of these democracies should cooperate together. And then he follows up with a trip in 2015, a summit meeting with the Indian Prime Minister Modi to establish a special strategic and global partnership. And then in May 2017, Abe and Modi announced during an African Development Bank summit meeting their Asia-Africa Growth Corridor concept. And it's no accident that this initiative was announced about a week after China's celebrated Belt and Road Forum. So in many ways, Abe is really personally the driving force behind this Indo-Pacific strategy. But we should also remember that the building blocks of this strategic concept predates Abe. You know, I would say that one beginning of this is soon after 9/11, when under Prime Minister Koizumi, the Japan Maritime Self-Defense Force begins to participate in maritime refueling operations in the Indian Ocean, something that had been unthinkable in the past. Also, under Prime Minister Koizumi, Japan began to talk about an expanded East Asia, and this is really kind of the fallout from the wake of the 1997 East Asian financial crisis. Prime Minister Koizumi
put forth the notion of the ASEAN plus three plus three as an alternative to China's championing of the ASEAN plus three as the best way of promoting economic regionalism. And what was noteworthy about Khoizmi's announcement was that he included India as well as Australia and New Zealand as the plus three. And the idea here was that these three democracies, by being part of this economic regional initiative, would provide a good counterweight to China's growing influence. Now later, this notion develops into the Comprehensive Economic Partnership for East Asia, and then it morphs into the ASEAN-centered Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership talks, the so-called RCEP talks. Another kind of precursor to the Indo-Pacific strategy was a 2004 Japanese initiative on anti-piracy operations. It was Japan that promoted what's known as RECAP, the Regional Cooperation Agreement on Combating Piracy and Armed Robbery Against Ships. RECAP now has 20 member countries, and they include India, China, United States, Japan, Australia, and other countries. And then afterwards, Japan passed an anti-piracy law and began to engage in anti-piracy operations in the Horn of Africa. So these are all kind of precursors, and so in a sense, Abe was building upon the activity that predated him. And so what was the motivation that Japan had for this? Well, clearly, the major motivation was the rise of China and the concerns about the long-term direction of U.S. foreign policy after the end of the Cold War. And there was, I think, a national consensus among the foreign policy machinery in Japan that Japan needed to become more proactive to help shape a regional and global environment that would be congenial to Japan's long-term interests. That it was inadequate for Japan to remain a reactive state. The other realization was that although the U.S.-Japan alliance was critical to Japan's long-term interests, they realized it will increasingly become insufficient for Japan's long-term interests. But at the same time, they realized if pursuing a proactive policy, Japan recognized that there was a relative decline of its own economic capabilities, and so the traditional economic diplomacy or checkbook diplomacy could no longer be the primary mode of Japanese activism. And then at the same time, although many Japanese strategists thought that Japan should play a much more active military role in international affairs, they also recognized that there were severe domestic political constraints to prevent this. And therefore, Abe and others in the foreign policy community sought to frame Japan's diplomatic international activism in terms of norms and values rather than just a contribution of material, economic, and defense capabilities. And so when you read any of the descriptions of Japan's free and open Indo-Pacific strategy, the highlight is in terms of general principles and values, an emphasis on freedom, the rule of law, freedom of navigation, the market economy, international behavior that is free of force and the use of force and coercion. And then at the same time, they always talk about two confluences, the confluence between the Pacific and the Indian Oceans and the confluence between Asia and Africa. Now, Deepa asks, you know, whether the driving force are strategic or economic. I think for Japan, this is a tradition in Japanese foreign policy that they take a comprehensive approach. It's not whether it's security or economics, but if you think strategically in Japan, economics and security go together. But I think the key innovation of the free and open Indo-Pacific is basically as a vehicle to expand Japan's geographic horizons of its Asia policy. Heretofore, the geographic focus of Japan's Asia policy was Southeast Asia and ASEAN. And still, I think ASEAN remains the pivotal sub-region for Japan's Asia policy, and the current foreign minister, Kono, has reaffirmed that. But the Japanese realize that Asia is being redefined, and Japan needs to participate in the shaping of that region. So the key innovation of the free and open Indo-Pacific is that it provides a way for Japan to expand and deepen its ties with India, and then with India to expand and deepen Japan's ties with Africa. And so that's the salient connectivity that is innovative in the free and open Indo-Pacific. It's the linking of Asia to Africa, and this is why we had the Asia-Africa Growth Corridor concept. And in this connectivity, I think the Japanese think about some kind of tacit division of labor. The Japanese could provide a lot of the funding and the know-how in terms of economic assistance, but Japan understands that it does not have much of a link with Africa. They're really behind China in terms of Africa, and so India could provide that personal connection, especially through the Indian diaspora. And then the United States, of course, might be a source of funding, but the key thing that the United States brings to the table is probably its military and its participation in various peacekeeping operations. I would say that there is a broad general consensus about the Indo-Pacific strategy. And, you know, at the broad level, this is not a divisive issue. But when you get into some of the details of how then to implement the strategy, there are some clear differences. And let me just highlight four very quickly. One is regarding China policy. There's no question that Japan's concerns about the rise of China was probably the number one motivator. But there are differences in Japan about how much Japan should use the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy to push back against China, and in what way. There are some who feel that the policy should be a mixed policy of competition through soft balancing, but also positive engagement with China. But there are others that favor a much more vigorous competition with China, including hard balancing, even on the military front. I would say that Prime Minister Abe instinctually may have favored the second viewpoint, but over time, he has moved towards the first. Secondly, an issue of debate is the role of the self-defense forces. There is a consensus in Japan in favor of anti-piracy operations, humanitarian assistance and disaster relief operations, making port calls, more military exercises, including in the South China Sea. Recently, Japan participated in submarine exercises. Again, a new development. But there is still debate in Japan about whether Japan should participate in assertive U.S.-led freedom of navigation operations to counter China's excessive claims. I mean, there's real concern about the limitations of Japanese capabilities and a potential Chinese backlash in the East China Sea. A third issue that is of debate is about democracy and human rights. I think there is a general consensus in Japan that the best way to promote democratization and human rights is still through economic and social development. But there are some voices in Japan which probably might converge with some of the voices in the United States that thinks that Japan should be much more open in its criticisms of human rights violations, whether it's in Myanmar, Cambodia, Tibet, Xinjiang. But that is a divisive issue in Japan. And finally is the issue of resources behind the free and open Indo-Pacific strategy. Abe, in 2015, announced that he earmarked $110 billion from 2016 to 2020 for infrastructure development in Asia, which is a 30% increase. That sounds like a lot, and you know it is a lot, but it may pale in comparison to what China brings to the table. But also, when you look at the long-term trajectory, if you look at kind of public money for official development assistance, Japan has still not recovered from the effect of the bubble economy. I remember the days when Japan was up there with the United States in terms of the amount of ODA. Now Japan has fallen to fourth places behind not only the United States, but the UK and Germany. It's about where France says the amount of official development assistance is a little bit more than half of that of the United Kingdom. And in terms of the percentage of gross national income for its official development assistance, Japan ranks 18th in the world. So although you know there's a lot of excitement about what Abe is doing, but when you look at the amount of money, Japan probably could contribute much more if it was going to even be up there with Germany and the UK. But given the growing public deficit and increasing Social Security expenditures, plus more demands for defense spending, it's going to be hard to see how much more money Japan can contribute. Now finally, just on the point about the United States, Abe is very happy about the U.S. embrace of the Indo-Pacific strategy. And is very happy that the Trump administration seems to want to build up Americans' military capabilities and maintain the presence in the Indo-Pacific. But at the same time, as you all know, Japan has been very disappointed by Trump's withdrawal from the TPP and the pursuit of a trade war with China that then could expand to other countries, even Japan. And so what I find really interesting was Bob and we were talking about the changes in U.S.-China relations, kind of a slow but clear deterioration in U.S.-China relations. But because of the uncertainties of U.S. foreign policy, China and Japan are unmistakably improving their relationship. So in a sense, they're going in opposite directions. And so finally, from Japan's vantage point, does the free and open Indo-Pacific lead to greater connectivity or conflict? And I would say that it really depends upon the future of U.S.-China relations and the extent to which Japan and other countries who are, of course, wary of China but who still want to avoid a conflict with China, whether they will be able to play a role in moderating the current negative dynamic in U.S.-China relations. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. Let's move next to the funding. I think you've got a PowerPoint, right?
Yes, I'm just so
okay.
This.
Richard,
The outset, let me thank Professor Olapalli for this invitation, and I must say that it's an absolute pleasure to be here with this panel. Distinguished speakers, at my pleasure to be here. Let me start with that point towards the end, what Dr. Mike actually mentioned, that when we talk about Indo-Pacific, I think there is this broad consensus among the so-called like-minded countries that what Indo-Pacific is really about. And I think India conveniently falls there. And the point which, from Indian point of view, the point which is very clear that I think the convergence on the liberal values and democracy on the liberal frameworks of thought process in the Indo-Pacific is more with US and Japan, and along with other like-minded countries in the region, rather than the differences. I think the convergence points are more rather than differences. But the difference points are actually the most problematic issues. And I think that has been the defining point in Indo-Pacific recently, and that we need to really talk about, at least from Indian point of view. And therefore, I do argue that the India's standpoint on Indo-Pacific is the defining and limit in the Indo-Pacific connectivity trends. And I must thank the Professor Olapalli for this topic, connectivity and conflict, because if you see the trend of the 21st century, I think there have been four or five major issues the 21st century politics has lived with. One is, of course, the first few years, that is the rise of China. Then we moved to the second stage where we talked about the US pivot strategy to Asia. The third stage, we talked about BRI. Now, the fourth stage, we are talking about the connectivity in Indo-Pacific. And I think this is the right time where we are actually bringing everything together. China, US, the BRI, which is the flagship initiative of Xi Jinping, which is linked with China's 2035-49 developmental plan, which is based on their comprehensive national power strategy, what I think Professor Sartre would rightly mention about. And now we're talking about connectivity politics. Among all these things, I think the lesser known actor, which was not there till now, but now making a statement, is India. If you see the role of India and the position of India from where India operates in the Indo-Pacific, it was always a difficult enterprise for India to take a position. Obviously, China is the most immediate neighbor, and then US is a traditional strategic partner. What has been the most defining element about Indian foreign policy recently is that the current government under Prime Minister Modi has taken few initiatives which has been in some ways not only defining but also going to decide a lot of future trends about Indo-Pacific. And let me start with that very defining moment of Indian foreign policy, which currently everybody is talking about. That is Prime Minister Modi's speech at the Shangri-La Dialogue. And if you talk about Prime Minister Modi's speech about Shangri-La Dialogue, it has actually defined Indo-Pacific in such a context, which is again, India is with the liberal world, India is with the ethics, values, and with the like-minded countries, and at the same time, India is not. So therefore, we need to clearly differentiate the convergence and the divergences that India actually brings to the Indo-Pacific regions in order to not only understand India's foreign policy and India's policies towards Indo-Pacific, but also the entire gamut of politics that is evolving in Indo-Pacific. Now, what he interestingly said is that he talked about that India, like Japan and many other countries, India believes in free and open Indo-Pacific. But he also interestingly mentioned about that while India believes in free and open Indo-Pacific, India also believes in inclusive Indo-Pacific. And I think that is one thing which is the defining moment in Indian Indo-Pacific foreign policy. The term inclusive implies that it doesn't really exclude anything, and doesn't really exclude a region, doesn't really exclude a power. So